Welcome, dear listeners, to the Fourth World's podcast of Transmission in Motion, with me, your host, Chris Julien. On this Fourth World's podcast, I invite theorists and researchers Iris van der Tuin and Joost de Blois to talk about knowledge cultures and interdisciplinary practices in relation to the particular aesthetic and political encounters of the modern and the non-modern implied by the Fourth World. To my mind, this encounter of worlds speaks to the present, and has something important to say about living on a damaged planet, as Anat Singh put it. As an opening piece, you just listened to a river song from the album Music and Poetry of the Cache by Todd Barton and famed novelist Ursula K. Le Guin. It serves as an introduction of an elusive musical genre that I find evocative and a friend in charting new theoretical spaces, another form of experimental evidence or proof that another world is possible, taking on questions of cultural exchange and hybridization, while attending equally to its problematic histories and utopian horizons. The story of Fourth World as a musical genre starts with its proposal by John Hassell, who released two volumes of Fourth World possible musics in the late 70s, inspired by Malaysian indigenous Senoi dream theory and Semmelai water splashing music. On these, a musical style took shape that draws on Japanese minimalism, electronics, ethnographic recordings, and his own background in European serial and Indian classical music. In his own words, Fourth World is a viewpoint, out of which evolve guidelines for finding balances between accumulated knowledge and the conditions created by new technologies. In recent years, there has been a resurgence of interest in this nexus of electronic and ethnographic sounds, where native and synthetic forms of music foreground both the paradoxes and emergent possibilities of Anthropocenes. As Spencer D. of Visible Cloaks notes, there is something in the artificiality of this imagined space that both compels and confuses me. It's all very intentionally disorienting, bringing up questions about identity and how it is shifting in global culture. Now, crossing paths with this strangely contemporary music is a political vision also articulated in the 1970s that speaks in equal measure to the present, albeit in overtly emancipatory keys. The story of Fourth World as a geopolitics was proposed by George Manuel as a horizon for indigenous political activism in his book The Fourth World, an Indian Reality. The term was suggested to him by Mbuto Milando, sketching out a non-modern horizon for geopolitics. And I quote, "When native peoples come into their own, on the basis of their own cultures and traditions, that will be the Fourth World." With the Fourth World, Manuel and others sought a common lexicon, a socio-cultural political lexicon, that would contribute to a better understanding of what increasingly came to be recognized as a common experience. Taken together, these Fourth Worlds speak to a certain multiplication of thought, of epistemic and aesthetic encounters. As such, Fourth World proposes both a geopolitics of situated knowledges and the creative principle of knowledge production that do not choose sides, circulating cosmologies and epistemologies on equal footing. Yet they do so rooted in the material and lived practices of their progenitors, attesting to an irreversible entanglement of cultural and epistemic practices. For today's show, I had the pleasure of talking to Iris van der Tuin and Joost de Blois. Iris is professor of theory of cultural inquiry at Utrecht University and director of the School of Liberal Arts, as well as program director of the interdisciplinary bachelor's program Liberal Arts and Sciences. Joost is philosopher and assistant professor at the University of Amsterdam, departments cultural analysis and comparative literature. He has published extensively on the nexus between art and politics in Volume, Metropolis M, Open, and other magazines. He is the author of Bajou at Bohm Publishers and Alain Bajou in Aesthetics, Art, Politics, and Philosophy at Octavo. I had the pleasure of talking to Iris and Joost about how knowledge comes last in diffraction, the emancipatory potential of the algorithmic condition, epistemologies of the South, and the university as a battleground.
Czy jest miłość, bo nie bał się mi, bo zbierz, trwał nie. welcome, Iris, and thanks for taking some time out of your busy schedule on this lovely day. It's great to have you here on the inaugural show and in this fourth world airspace, as it were.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our listeners just heard Keys by Visible Cloaks, a song which, according to them, offers a hopeful glimpse into the future of interbeing of human and post-human inhabitants, where speech centralizes and synthesizes as multiversal melody embedded across generative landscapes under open, liquid skies. And so I'm interested to hear from you to what extent this kind of music and this kind of space speaks to your ideas in terms of its wide-ranging material sources, as well as a type of methodology or perhaps an instance of interdisciplinary knowledge production, and then in particular in relation to the algorithmic condition. So I'd like to invite you to kick off with some comments on the way you see these different modalities of knowledge and culture interacting, and in particular the relevance of non-modern modes of knowledge production in these times of ubiquitous computing.
Well, thank you for this question. Of course, it's a broad and a deep question. So where to start? I remember once I wrote an article that I had wanted to title something along the lines of ecological epistemology, with which I wanted to draw attention to the fact that epistemology and ontology are always entangled, and also that knowledge production not only happens in culture, but also in nature, because nature and culture are entangled. So to me, this is exactly what this kind of music and also the epistemological and political backgrounds of this kind of music, communicates, or what that relates to. An ecological epistemology, I find it very, very important to think along such lines, especially also when it comes to media and the ubiquitous nature of media, of information, of machine learning, of all kinds of data and algorithm-driven processes. And I guess that the idea of a media ecology was phrased very early on by McLuhan to actually give voice to such ideas. That would be my first response. You also mentioned interdisciplinarity, and of course, interdisciplinarity is something that that you need both as a perspective, as a set of values, and as a methodology to do justice to the fact that the entanglements that I just mentioned find their way in research. And it is actually, on purpose that I mention a value, because as a director or coordinator of a bachelor's program, one is always asked to think along the lines of knowledge, skills, maybe attitudes, and then when the meeting has already ended, you may talk about values. But I would say that especially in this era, in these times, we should actually swap this quantification of what students need. We should start with values. Then we move to attitudes, to actually, learning students to respect all kinds of academic knowledges and non-academic knowledges. Then skills are needed, and knowledge actually comes last, not because it is less important, but because we need to teach students the skills to first understand what kind of knowledge they need for their scientific and societal project.
Great. I like the one-liner of saying that knowledge comes last, and this kind of ties into my next question, which I wanted to focus the previous question a bit more on your own practice and the role that non-academic sources of reference play in your work, either as discrete objects or knowledge, or perhaps as creative or methodological references. And then also specifically, I'm curious what role might be assigned to diffraction as a practice or a phenomena that plays between academic and non-academic thoughts.
Yeah, well, diffraction for me is always important because it refers to this first moment of being lured into doing creative research. And this moment happens behind one's desk during planned periods of doing research. But then it can actually also happen when you're in the supermarket or walking around in the forest, or you know, you're sitting on the train reading a random newspaper that was left behind by someone. So this to me is diffraction. So diffraction is a tool that that leads you to respecting the entire idea of never really knowing when the research starts. And it also points at the necessity to unpack what this moment entails in all its fullness, if you get my point. So and then there is this this short article that I wrote on Virginia Woolf, in which she says that, you know, or at least I'm kind of interpreting that it's her. She sits in her house in London, looking out of the window, and she sees a leaf fall from a tree, and then she basically follows that tree and basically lists what she sees through the leaf, in a way. So she sees a leaf, a tree, a street, a taxi cab, a couple, you know, so the entire city of London ends up being folded into this one leaf. And to me, this is diffraction. So, and I've used many conceptual tools to write meaningfully about this moment. But so I wrote about, like, Bergson, for example. In my work, I've used many conceptual tools to write meaningfully about diffraction as this very full and thick moment of starting your work as a researcher, and also the unexpectedness, in a way, of this moment. So one of these tools is Bergson saying that you know, your entire being, in a way, can be how do you say that? Your entire being can kind of vibrate like a stone that falls into the water of a pond when you notice something. And to me, that's, of course, this stone falling into the water of a pond also generates a diffractive pattern. So there is even a one-on-one relation between this Bergson quote and between diffraction. As a tool that originally comes from Barat, but has also been traced back to Haraway and Trin Minha, but it is this vibration, in a way, of you basically feel that you're onto something, and you have no idea what it is, but you have to research what you have just found or experienced. And of course, this is an ideal type of doing diffractive research, because I've seen scholars and students also deliberately using diffraction, so deciding that, you know, I'm going to read Sik Su through Barat and see what comes out of it. And of course, that's important too, but the more interesting and more ecological examples of diffraction are, for me, these these unexpected moments that are so full and thick that you have to do a lot of work in order to figure out what you have just found.
Yeah, so a very, let's say, intuitive understanding of the method as such. I like that you say that there's this full moment of starting your work.
Yes, it is indeed intuitive. And in that sense, maybe you need some sort of faculty in order to recognize that the moment as such. I mean, we walk around and there's noticings always and continuously. But what is a noticing that works for your research? And of course, you need to have some sort of pre-knowledge or some sort of maybe that is a set of values or an attitude in order to actually act on it. And together with my colleagues from Liberal Arts and Sciences, I was reading an article on serendipity a while ago. So the importance of serendipity for interdisciplinary research. And of course, the point is then there are serendipitous moments, like constantly, like go do research online and you find sources, authors, images, all the time. But then how much knowledge or what kind of attitude or what set of values do you need in order to actually recognize, hey, this is a serendipitous moment or a serendipitous finding that is important and that needs following up. And that's we were talking about this contradictory the contradictory nature of saying something like that. You need knowledge, values, a certain attitude in order to act on something that, you know, you call serendipitous. It was a very interesting discussion, and I think there's a lot to research on this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The next question I'd like to turn to, and this is maybe strongly in reference also to what the fourth world evokes, is this kind of question of worlding. So on the one hand, we might say there's this question of attitude and values and being able to pluck the moment out of the sky serendipitously. And on the other hand, I wonder, is it relevant also to speak of this horizon of worlding in your work, of this idea that all this research and all these moments occur in a certain type of world that is maybe conducive or into greater or lesser degree of that diffraction and of these associations?
For me, this is not really a question. It's just simply something that I would like to affirm. And I would say that, for example, as an educator in an interdisciplinary context, we would always say that we try to make students aware not only of certain conflicts that occur between sets of knowledges or sets of values and attitudes, but also we want to make them aware or create like shared horizons. And of course, you know, we can reread this kind of language of shared horizons in an ecological or new materialist key. And a shared horizon can be something that you find simply because there is something that you share and it's in dialogue that you find out that this is a sharing, but it is also something that you collectively, and that's important, I think, when it comes to worlding, and that you collectively work towards.
So for me personally, the inspiration of bringing in this space of fourth world is the fact that it has a certain type of eclecticism that does involve, let's say, cosmologies or world forms that are very non-modern and both challenge and inspire maybe our own sense of world and the possibilities that has, as well as maybe raising questions of responsibility. But what I really find interesting about your statement now is both, let's say, the affirmation of the operation of shared horizons, but also this idea of collectively working towards them as maybe an obligation or at least a vector.
It is an obligation and it is a necessity that like Lyotard, let me start here. At the end of the 70s, Lyotard wrote this book on the postmodern condition. And in response to, which was a book about the arrival of ICTs at universities and questions of legitimacy, etc., that then arose. With the work that I do together with colleagues on the algorithmic condition, we wanted to push this argument to today. So it's not only ICTs, it's extremely networked and algorithmic machines that have now arrived at the university. But what I find nowadays even more interesting is not just this adjective, so moving away from postmodern and towards algorithmic, but to actually reflect a little bit more on this word condition. Because condition etymologically has a double meaning. It's a condition, a situation that we find ourselves in, a set of values, a form of being, but it is also a verb, to condition. So what conditions us, and how can we actually take into consideration that these conditions they exclude certain ways of knowing and being, but they also include certain ways of knowing and being. So in response to your question or to your take on fourth world, I would like to say let's think a little bit about this our current condition as something that is both factual and that is processual and very ontological. What is enabled and what is disabled in our current condition by the very conditions that we live with and within?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So I think this brings us to my last question, which is a move into a more overtly political space. And let's say the political horizon of your work. And I'm curious whether you see your own work as also being constituted by an emancipatory horizon. And when we look at the institution of the university, like what kind of modalities there are for amplifying such a horizon?
Yeah. It is a conscious choice to work for a program that calls itself interdisciplinary. Of course, the examples that I gave of my work with students have stayed within the realm of the university. So I talked about different disciplines having common grounds, but also conflict. I would like for my program to be more transdisciplinary, because I think that not only the world needs a transdisciplinary take on knowledge production, but also students thrive by bringing in what they know, because they've lived through certain experiences, or they make certain observations also outside the university. I started out in academia as a feminist scholar, and as a feminist scholar, together with my classmates, I kind of decided to take the university as my playing ground, because it has feminism has by now a 50-year long relation with the university, and its work at the university is not finished. So I really wanted to work on a less patriarchal, less Oedipal university, a university that is less hierarchically organized, a university where knowledge is less hierarchically organized. And perhaps that also shows you why I'm so interested in the algorithmic condition, because of course, with company-owned algorithms that have not been disclosed, there's a huge impact of corporations and big money and the economy at the university at this point, and this is an understudied topic. But also algorithms and algorithmic, finding an algorithmic way of moving through all kinds of knowledges. That is also that can also be a very emancipatory process for young students. So when you tell students that whatever they find on their mobile devices, on their laptops, they may potentially bring that to the classroom. I think that is a very emancipatory act, and of course you have to tell them how algorithms work and. But an algorithmic organization of knowledge production is a less hierarchical organization. So I would like to work towards that.
Great. So maybe as just a small final question, I would be curious to hear if there are certain, let's say, transdisciplinary practices or phenomena that you for yourself find in particular inspiring or helpful to bring in to your work. Also as a way of, let's say, elaborating on your take on transdisciplinarity.
I must say that I find this a difficult question, because as a scholar, I'm kind of most attracted to finding those voices, usually actually of the past, that have not made it to the canon. That's actually what most inspires me, finding the female Alfred North Whitehead that we don't read. So these kinds of practices, and then immediately, and this is really something that I truly adore doing, finding a person like that and trying to figure out in what kind of curriculum I could plug that woman. So I'm spreading the news is about a new finding, a new serendipitous finding is something that I really like. Most of my inspiration does happen behind my desk, and I do remember that in the preface to my dissertation, I wrote something like a clean desk is a sign of a wasted desk life. And I guess I live with that.
Taking Sara Ahmed, I guess, also seriously in that respect.
Absolutely. So, yes, and then also, of course, as a materialist, there are a lot of very material. I mean, the desk is a material object, and lots of philosophers, male philosophers, have referred to the desk in passing. And of course, as a feminist scholar, you know that a desk is always in a particular situation. And there are a lot of others, human and non-human, that work towards that desk life. Mm-hmm. And I like to think about that kind of life, and both critically and creatively.
That's fantastic. So looking at my own desk here, I think I'm happy to be in the same space as you, with lots of inspiration and various objects staring back at me. I know you're almost back into your educator role and to some big meetings. So I would like to leave it at this, and thank you so much for your comments and thoughts on the Transmission in Motion podcast.
Thank you so much, Chris.
So Joost, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here in this fourth world space for the first show at that. And as a note to listeners, Joost is currently supervising my thesis. So among us, Joost is usually the one posing questions to me on Skype. So I'm happy to reverse the tables today.
Good.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what I'd provisionally gather under the rubric of the epistemologies of the South, with the Sousa Santos. And I'm curious as to the consequences in your practice of picking up on this development. They seem to me to be somewhere between philosophy and anthropology. So could you comment on the way these shifts in boundaries of reference of knowledge are influencing the trajectory of the humanities and academic thought in your perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's to begin with, right? It's a very broad, almost global question, in a sense. But you're absolutely right in pointing out that this is perhaps the major shift within the humanities at large over the past, I don't know, it's not even that long ago, maybe over the past 20 years. That is to say, the acknowledgement, first of all, that the humanities are not perhaps as universal or universalizing as they pretended to be, and you acknowledge that other forms of knowledge, of knowing and thought, are not only possible but are effectively present already. And there's a wonderful quote by a Brazilian philosopher and anthropologist called Eduardo Viveiros de Castro, who at some point says that anthropology and philosophy has for a very long time thought about other people, but not necessarily with other people. And what he's aspiring to do is to come to a kind of anthropology or philosophical anthropology with the others in it, as he calls it. So I think that this recognition that there are other ways of thinking out there, so beyond Europe, beyond, say, Western academia and a Western frame, that is a very important realization that is slowly occurring over the past, say 20 years. It has also affected my own work. I mean, I find it quite... I'm quite hesitant to talk about my own work since it is fairly eclectic. But I do think that this is one of the questions that I have touched upon. So the question of non-Western thought, or rather the relation between Western thought and non-Western thought, the outside, if you like, of Western thinking. And to a certain extent, I think it ties in with existing concerns or older concerns, obviously post-structuralism. So thinkers like Derrida, Deleuze, Levinas, they were also concerned with what they called the outside and the other. But I think in the case of post-structuralism, French post-structuralism, the other and the outside remained fairly abstract. They remained fairly empty, you could say. And what I think is interesting in critical thought today, in the humanities today, is that the other is someone, and someone who has something to say and things in his own right or her own right. And that the outside, in that sense, is not just an empty outside or an outside that is, you know, receding, constantly escaping or grasped, like it is the case with Derrida, for example. But it is an actual, it's a material outside. It's an existing outside. It's an outside that is somehow real. Yeah, and I think that also for me has been an important realization. But it's also the beginning, in a sense, of a struggle, because once you realize that, okay, the other exists, there is an other out there, there are other ways of thinking, that also forces you to situate yourself, and also you also feel forced to somehow engage with those other modes of thought, and that is by no means an easy task.
So just as a point of curiosity, do you sort of remember the period in which these kinds of thinking were sort of entering into academia and sort of your experience of that shift? Is this something you can recall?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think what an important shift has been is the transition from, say, post-colonial thinking, which is very much, this sounds a bit irreverent perhaps, but which is very much a 90s thing, I would say. Mm-hmm. So from post-colonial thinking to decolonial thinking. So from Western scholars, or at least scholars operating within a Western framework, thinking about the non-West, the post-colonial, the formerly colonial world, to scholars thinking from a non-Western framework, even if these scholars like Walter Mignolo, for example, is one of the leading names in decolonial theory. He works at Duke University in the US. He's trained in France. So in that sense, He's not literally outside of the West. He's still teaching and working within the West, but he's very much trying to think from outside of a Western frame. And there's many thinkers today who are doing that. I think that's an important transition. I think that took place, as I said, it's quite recent. I think this took place, say, 15, 20 years ago. So Mignolo's major works, they date from like the 2010s. I think his first major book on decolonial thinking dates from 2008 or something. So that's sort of, I think, the moment when that transition takes place.
Right.
This is not to say, of course, that outside of the West, right, so in Latin America, for example, there were obviously a lot of decolonial scholars already working, except that they weren't necessarily heard. So it's not that, the transition. So the transition that we're talking about is still very much a transition within Western academia.
Exactly.
So Joost, before we were rudely interrupted by the Wi-Fi connection, I was asking you if you could comment on how perhaps this shift in canon, this shift of who is speaking in the humanities, whether that also has influenced your style of teaching or your reflection on your role as an educator?
That's a very good question. Perhaps not as much as I would like to. Step one, obviously, is to include non-Western decolonial thinkers, theorists. That's definitely one thing that I'm trying to do. So I've been teaching on the work of Sylvia Winter, Walter Mignolo, Frantz Fanon, but these are by no means, in that sense, say original choices. This is basically the decolonial canon, if you like. But it's an important step, I think, because it also makes myself, but also students, very much aware that thinking, there is thought, occurring outside of a Western, often also outside of a strictly academic framework. I mean, interestingly, a lot of the, say, thinkers that are part of the decolonial canon, like Frantz Fanon, even Sylvia Winter, right, they are not necessarily affiliated to, say, Western academic institutions or have not been. Or think of someone like Edouard Glissant, for example, who operates sort of in between philosophy and poetry. So that's already interesting. So you get to be confronted not just with, say, a thought that originates elsewhere, but also a kind of thinking that has a different form, that has a different shape. And that is something you also need to incorporate in teaching. And also it's something that you need to sort of teach yourself to be able to decipher and to read. So I think that's an interesting project. But the real challenge, I think, has to do with, well, I guess what you could call sort of the double bind of contemporary academia. On the one hand, the university academic institutions are extremely international. So we have students from all over the place, including non-Western parts of the world, the global south, so India, Southeast Asia, Africa, etc. But on the other hand, we gather as students and teachers in English, and often within still very much, I would say, a Eurocentric academic frame. So we read European Western thinkers, whatever, Judith Butler, Derrida, Deleuze, etc., and often students from the global south explicitly come to us to study those texts. But it's very difficult to incorporate thinkers that operate in a different frame, so in a different linguistic frame, but also in a different epistemological frame. And there's a certain friction there. I think it's really interesting to discuss. I mentioned earlier Eduardo Viveros de Castro. That's one of the authors that I discuss often with students, and you can tell that they sometimes struggle with it, and they also they are on the one hand attracted to it. They feel almost like a like an ethical obligation to engage with it and to read it, and they also want to understand it. But on the other hand, they also find it difficult to situate themselves in relation to it. I think they are afraid. They are afraid to appropriate a certain way of thinking that doesn't necessarily belong to them, or that they feel sort of insecure with. That they feel it, you know, that they have an insufficient understanding of it. And I think one of the great difficulties, of course, is that there is a certain, what Derrida would call a certain monolinguism within academia. We teach and read in English. We teach and read texts that are that emerge from, say, an Anglophone, Eurocentric context. And it's very difficult to incorporate texts that are written in a different context, in a different language. And that is key, I think.
Tu dois baisser le salaire des fonctionnaires. Ils se sont tués, ils ont dit qu'on ne fait rien. L'école est devenue maintenant n'importe quoi. On continue toujours d'avancer. On cherche toujours les occasions. Il faut que, avant que Coco ne passe, la goutte d'eau dépasse de base.
Camerounais, mes chers compatriotes, l'année 2016 qui s'achève a été riche en événements pleins de signification pour notre nation.
Right, right. So there's of course a number of let's say tensions and fault lines that become let's say apparent in these introduction of these new or different modes of expression, modes of thinking. I'm curious to what extent you think, let's say, the politics of citation come to matter here. This dynamic, both literally in terms of who we cite and how we presence different parts of the canon. Also how we deal then with these different modes of enunciation or these different ways of speaking in coming to a text, and let's say the question of who's influencing who in these processes.
Yes, so there's the politics of citation, which I think is always a kind of politics of translation. And I think this is also important to be aware of, that I was earlier talking right about this hesitation that students sometimes seem to feel, and that I also personally feel right when reading non-Western authors often in translation. But I think that a certain kind of misreading is inevitable, and I also don't think that we should you know play the purity game too much. I don't think we should be. No, we should not be afraid precisely to misread, and be aware of the fact that any reading is a kind of translation. The translation is not necessarily a bad thing, and this is the main lesson, right, of authors like Derrida, for example, or Paul de Man. Any kind of misreading is a productive misreading. It produces a kind of surplus of meaning, and that in itself, I think, is not a bad thing. Certainly not if that surplus of meaning, right, emerges from a non-Western context, and it's not a bad thing to make, you know, an effort of translation, I think.
Absolutely. It also reminds me, let's say, of statement that John Hassell makes about fourth world music, of the, as he calls it, the awkwardness of bringing together these different, let's say, forms of expression, in this case music, and the question of what obligation or possibilities a white man from the southern United States has in, let's say, adopting or taking up all these indigenous forms of music and these field recordings. So this interplay of appropriation or of citation. And I'm curious whether or to what extent you see these epistemological developments also opening up into a new didactics or new forms of negotiating these distances and similarities.
Yeah, I think you have to make it. You have to distinguish, I think, between a kind of institutional responsibility. So in that sense, I think the issue of appropriation is very important. So we have to be, I think, very much aware of the fact that even if the University of Amsterdam isn't exactly, you know, Cornell or Harvard, it is still, I think, part of, you know, the of dominant Western academia. And it is very tempting in that sense, right, to appropriate non-Western thinkers and non-Western modes of thought. That is so much easier, right, if you're based in a European university than when you're based in, say, a Latin American university. So there is definitely an ethical aspect there, and I think we definitely need to be very careful there. On the other hand, as you said, there is also the epistemological side, which I think, and especially on that side, I think, so on the epistemological side, the issue of appropriation is I think less urgent, also less useful. I think precisely the intrusion, as you called it, of alternative modes of thought, of non-Western modes of thought, into our European way of thinking can be extremely productive. And this is, I mean, I see this really as a continuation of, say, the post-structuralist, the post-war continental philosophical project, where, for example, Levinas has tried to do the same thing with a Jewish philosophy, Jewish thinking, where, you know, someone like Derrida has tried to open up, you know, Western metaphysics, as he would call it, the metaphysics of presence, to its outside. The same goes for thinkers like Deleuze and Guattari, and I think that, as I said, the challenge today would be to look at that outside and that other as a concrete other and a concrete outside. Mm. As to the question of teaching and pedagogy, I think that's actually quite a difficult question. I find it, from my own experience, harder than I thought to incorporate these alternative modes of thinking, these non-Western epistemologies. I think it's easier to refer to them in the abstract sense, so as a challenge, if you like, to say the European way of thinking, the European philosophical project. I find it much more difficult to incorporate them on their own terms, so to speak.
Now, and I guess maybe also given your background and interests, that there is an obvious aesthetic, broadly speaking, component mm-hmm. to this in sense of forms. And one of my motivations for bringing this into a, let's say, fourth world space is also to understand, let's say, this negotiation or these interactions on an aesthetic level of forms that may mm-hmm. be different from what we're used to. Is this also, let's say, an interaction that you reflect on in terms of a politics of aesthetics?
That's a very good question. Again, I think it's quite complex, and also I'm a little bit skeptical. I think I'm a little bit skeptical about several aspects of that question, so to speak. So there's first of all, I think the relation between, say, epistemology, academic work, and artistic form, which is a relation that is being explored more and more today in both the art world and academia. So obviously artistic research has become quite institutionalized. And I'm a little bit skeptical, I think. So first of all, I'm all for experiments, and I can totally see that there is a genuine, say, intellectual concern there. And again, I think this is a continuation of a project that was started already in the 1930s in France, for example, with thinkers like Georges Bataille and Maurice Blanchot, who were also writing on the intersection, if you like, between philosophy, poetry, literature, autobiography, etc. And this was continued, especially in the 1970s, which was really the heyday, I think, of sort of experimental thought by Derrida in a book called Glas, which is a kind of weird experimental text, and again by Deleuze and Guattari in their A Thousand Plateaus. So there is, in that sense, I think, a general intellectual concern to see what, you know, different forms can bring us in terms of different modes of thinking. But there is also, I think, an institutional concern there that I'm a little bit more skeptical about. I think the art world in that sense, or the artistic and the intellectual, the academic world, are coming together more and more because they have no choice, because they both are being marginalized more and more. So in that sense, it is a little bit a marriage of convenience, so to say, in order to defend themselves in a way against, you know, ever more and ever more intruding economic logic, management logic, etc. In both, I think, the art world and the academic world. Yeah, I think a second aspect of this that is that there is a tendency, I think, in academia to look at art as a kind of refuge, as a space of experimentation, which is first of all a bit of a cliche, but also I'm not entirely sure if it does justice to the actual, say, political value of art. And I think 'cause it sort of pigeonholes art precisely as this, you know, space where anything is possible, but precisely because it doesn't have, you know, a distinguishable real world impact, so to say. And I think there is a bit of a danger for that to happen also with, say, non-Western epistemologies and non-Western modes of thinking, that we sort of tend to look at that as, well, a space for experimentation where things can be thought and said that cannot be said, you know, within the Western academic framework, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense, and sounds also preeminently modern. So maybe to tie those two points together, on the one hand, let's say an aesthetic quality that we can recognize as artistic, and on the other hand, this tendency to then incorporate these foreign or exotic elements as an instrument of our own intent. I know that you've been involved in, let's say, university and other protest actions in the past. And given that involvement, I'd love to hear you think a bit about the balance between, on the one hand, let's say, critical capacities, critical practice, but also, which I, with some trepidation, call prefigurative aspects of your world. What I'm trying to get at here is the interplay between critique and maybe a practice of worlding, which might not refer necessarily to art, but nonetheless refers to something of a of an effective environment that we create, on the one hand, and on the other hand, then also the challenge of negotiating or allowing these different versions of worlding to be present in our thinking and our academic work.
I think the biggest tension here is the tenacity, if you like, of the institution. So I'm all, in that sense, right, I'm all for worlding and prefiguration. And in the wake of the university occupation in 2015, I wrote a little book that basically focused on how the university occupation could be considered to be a kind of prefigurative politics, or a kind of worlding, if you like. So how can we not only represent but put into practice a different kind of university, different relations between professors and students, different ways of producing knowledge, different ways of teaching, and so on. And I think for the 7 weeks that occupation lasted, that actually was the case. So in that sense, I think there was a different world, if you like, not just, you know, metaphorically speaking, but I think it really was a different world from the university as it continues to exist today. But The institution has proven to be much more resilient, I think, than students and also critical professors at the time thought. So yes, I think we absolutely need a space for prefiguring a different world. But I'm also with Alain Badiou here. I think we should not underestimate how persistent the world as we know it, although Badiou probably would call this a non-world in the sense that it doesn't allow for anything new or original to occur. It's just a repetition of the same. But I think we shouldn't underestimate precisely how powerful and how persistent that non-world is. So in that sense, I am also a little bit skeptical, if you like, about the emphasis that we have in a lot of critical theory, also artistic theory and artistic work today on, say, the horizontal, the micro-political, and sort of the grassroots bottom-up movements. I think the weak point there is is by definition their temporal nature. And again, I think I am kind of with Badiou that if a new world is to emerge, it should be not just, you know, sustainable as the cliche wants it, but it should be durable. And I kind of like this idea of a duress, right? It should remain, and it should not be reduced to, you know, temporary interventions, you know, temporary collectives that at some point will dissolve, etc. But something of a new world should also be able to remain. And I think that's actually quite hard work. That's also quite hard institutional work, because it's very easy for the institution, especially for, say, a neoliberal institution, to create another niche as long as it is a profitable niche. Yeah. So I think the real challenge is not just to create a different world or to, you know, a different practice of worlding, but to make it last.
So Joost, before our listeners turn to Sugai Ken and a piece of his called Akta, which means dirt, rubbish, or mud, from an album called Gansekiko, which translates into Remarks on Rocks, I wanted to turn with you to this huge rock we were just discussing, namely the academic institution and its position in society as to addressing or even dealing with matters of justice and concern today. And then in particular related to political ecology and this idea of the university as part of an ecology, where you just commented on the challenge of creating durable change rather than maybe creative or notional change.
Yeah. Okay, so I agree with you that the academic institution and the same goes I believe completely for the art world. It continues to be a kind of battleground. I think it's very tempting to look at the contemporary university exclusively in economic terms. But I believe that it is still a political and social battleground in the sense that I think the university could be a space of resistance against, say, the ever-intruding neoliberal economic logic of profit, right? It's a space where, to a certain extent, we don't have to work, or at least we don't have to work for a profit. So in that sense, I think it allows for, at least technically speaking, you could say theoretically speaking, it allows for a different kind of worlding, a worlding that is not based on solely relations of profits, relations of economic exchange. And we seem to have forgotten that because we are, you know, to a very large extent, subject to precisely that logic, a logic of output, right, a logic of excellence and what you name all the cliches. But I think the university is still quite a unique institution that potentially offers an alternative to that. And the same goes, I think, to a very large extent for the art world. And I think right now there is another aspect of that of that institution as a battleground that is eminently political. I mean, the university has always been an international institution, an institution that was never really tied to a specific culture or a specific language. And I think that is also more and more under threat today. The international, let's say, cosmopolitan which is a new kind of swear word today, right? Cosmopolitan, the cosmopolitan nature of the university. And of course, in the past, right, that internationalism or cosmopolitanism was conceived as universalism. But yeah. I think there's a different way of doing that, right? You can also conceive of internationalism, cosmopolitanism, precisely as an ecology of knowledges, as an open space where different modes of thinking, where thinking in different languages from different cultures is possible. So outside of the framework of not just of Eurocentrism, but also outside of this idea of universalism, of universal knowledge. So I think the university in that sense can be an important catalyst, if you like, of that kind of an ecology of knowledges. But as I said, it's hard work. So it means that we are open to different ways of thinking, that we are, to do the, you know, the hard linguistic work, for example, of getting to know other cultures, other modes of thinking, and also that we are, prepared to do the hard epistemological work. I mean, if we're prepared, right, to read and fully understand an author like Heidegger, for example, or Hegel, we can also do the same hard work for non-Western philosophers.
Yes, that's a very good point. And I find it also, let's say, a heartening and emancipating thought not to have to read any more Heidegger, but to turn with the same sense of obligation to non-Western thinkers. So I guess that's all for today. Thanks so much for contributing all these lovely thoughts to this show.
You're welcome.
And I guess we'll be seeing each other very soon.
Absolutely. Absolutely.